You're listening to Truth to You Radio with Jono on truthtoyou.org. That's truth2letteru.org, where you can sign up for the weekly newsletter, and you can also keep up to date via iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. G'day wherever you may be around the world, and thanks for joining us once again, because it's time for Light of the Prophets with Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, Yoel.
G'day, you too. So what exactly did we do with Samson this week?
Well, we did get through chapter 13 last week. And so now we find ourselves in a place called Timnah in chapter 14. And it says that that Samson went down to Timnah and saw a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. Now, how do you pronounce it? Do you pronounce it Timnah in Hebrew?
It's written Timnata.
Timnata.
Yeah, Timnata. But Timnata, that's what's called a directive suffix. He's going towards the place called Timnah. Now, by the way, this is Timnah with a hey, not with an ayin. There's a place called Timnah, which is one, and the Timnah, which is another place. Now, if we think about it for a second, what exactly the Philistines says? So the Philistines, as I mentioned, came from the Greek islands, and they mostly sat in the coastal lane, which means most of the Judeans were probably in the mountains. This is why it says Vayered, and he went down. He basically went down from the area where they were sitting into the valley where the region is. And we have to understand something very, very simple. If we remember the book of Joshua, they mostly conquered the mountain. And the coastal plain was really controlled by Philistines and the other areas as well. So there's a lot going up and down in this. If you actually ever go to the Judean plain, because really the tribe of Dan was having difficulty, and the next story we have also deals with the tribe of Dan having difficulty with a place of dwelling. We're basically living inside the area of the tribe of Judah, because they were wouldn't be able to. They were basically a small tribe, and they were basically one family. And they're trying to control a scenario, and they're not able to. So they're basically hiding up in the mountain because they can't control the area that they're in. But at one point, the Philistines were pushed down more and more and more, to a point where they were mostly in the area of Gaza, Ashkelon, Gat, basically the southern coastal area of Israel. By the way, most of the Philistines at the time is actually now in Israeli control. The only area that's still under someone else's control is the area of Gaza. So it's called Timnah, and Timnata is a change that we do in the word just to accommodate the suffix that turns into directive. It also might be Timnat, but I doubt it. I think it's Timnah.
Okay. And
he's looking at girls from the Philistines. Now, this is an interesting paradox with him, because on one hand, he's a God-sent person. On the other hand, he's looking a lot around women in the stories, and but there's
not,
a reason.
It's not just that he's looking at women. He's looking at the daughters of the Philistines, Yoel. And I mean, we know from in the Torah, Exodus 34:16 and Deuteronomy 7:3, it says don't take the daughters of the nations around you. It says specifically in Deuteronomy 7:3, I've got it here, nor shall you make marriages with them. You shall not give your daughter to be to their sons, nor take their daughters for your sons. So is he not just blatantly disregarding these commandments?
So the answer is no, because the commandment there is talking about the seven nations. The Philistines are not on the list.
Truly. Okay. But wait a minute. Isn't the Philistines among the, would they not be included as a nation in a land of Canaan that is to be dispossessed?
No.
They're not listed as such.
They're not listed. The Philistines are not listed because they probably showed up on the scene afterwards. We're not too sure exactly what their history is. There is history. There is known history of who they were. But essentially, we're talking, this is hundreds of years after the final giving of the Torah, and they probably showed up around that time. Or maybe earlier than that, but they do not appear in the list, which is very interesting. So if the question is he doing something against Torah, the answer is no. But there is an objection for him marrying a woman from these people, and they actually say something very interesting. He goes, turns around to his parents, and he says, I saw a woman in Timnah, and from the daughters of Philistines, and now take her from me as a wife. And his parents say to him, "Are there any daughters amongst your brothers from all our people, a woman which you are taking into, you're going to take a woman from the Philistines, the uncircumcised?" It's very interesting. It reminds me of prophecy in Ezekiel, where he talks about certain nations, and it's kind of interesting. He says he mentions certain nations as being uncircumcised, and then their nation doesn't say anything about that. So one of the things is that it seems that the nations in this area, whoever was in this area, actually did practice circumcision to a certain degree. And here his parents are going to learn, they're using the uncircumcised as like a, you know, yuck, they're not circumcised. Kind of like the story with Dinah, where the circumcision is as something appalling, something which is kind of very negative. And even until this very day, you know, when someone lives in Israel, and he mentions, for example, we have issues with Russians who came here to Israel and they grew up as completely secular and they're not circumcised. And then when they mention they're not circumcised, most Jews go like, ugh. They have a difficulty accepting the idea. So using the word uncircumcised, not just to saying that, you know, physically they're not circumcised, it's actually using it as some kind of a mockery or distaste towards these people. You know, they're not circumcised, you know.
So his response to his father is, "Get her for me, for she pleases me well," is what he says. And so two questions I have about that. Get her for me, is that up to him to go and make the deal? Is that up to him to go and secure her?
Yeah, so the thing is that actually doesn't say that she pleases him. It says yashara b'aynai, and the word yashara is straight, which means she seems to be worthy in my eyes.
Okay.
So pleases is something else. Here we're talking about, no, she's okay. She's like, as if we're saying she's kosher. She's fine. You know, I have no problem with her.
Okay. So, because I wanted to ask you, is he saying, hey, she's a bit of all right. I like the look of her. I lust after her. I want her. Or is he saying, she seems to me that she's going to be a good wife. This is the kind of woman that I want.
So the issue using the eyes. So again, there are two elements here. There's when someone writes something, they're just writing the story, they're editing it. And there's a question here. What does it mean that she's straight in his eyes? Is the eyes just another way of saying perception in his mind? Or are we mentioning his eyes? Because essentially the story of Shimshon is he was led by his eyes and actually brought to his demise. And
very good point. Very good point. I didn't think of that. Yeah, it's a possibility. There's two possibilities there.
Yeah, so there's little pointers that come out here and there. But what's very, very important here is the next verse. And it says here, "And his mother and father did not know that from the Lord it is, for he's trying to look for an excuse from the Philistines." And at that time, the Philistines rule over Israel. And this is the thing. So it raises an interesting question. It reminds me of a verse in Mishle, in Proverbs, where it says, God uses the righteous and the wicked the same way. Basically, anything and anyone could be an instrument in the hands of God, which raises the question, is Samson really criticized here for what he does? Or is he, you know, is it just accepted the fact that he was used in a certain way to get revenge at the Philistines? That's another thing about Samson. He is the character represents the issue of balance of revenge, of an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, where they do something and he reacts to it, and then he does something and they react to it. And it's basically an interesting element of the issue of judgment of God, where you do something, you get the exact same thing, which reminds me of Ovadiah, where he says, "As you have done to you, as you have done, will be done to you. Your reward will be put upon your head." Where we get kind of a glimpse of how God governs the world. Where you do something, you get the exact same thing, which is very, very interesting. And there's actually an entire book I have here at home which deals with this subject, because it's a very important subject. You know, how does God govern the world? Why are certain things done? And we get a glimpse of it also here. But what's interesting here is basically God's using elements of his personality, probably as being a person who's maybe hypersexual or something, and God is using those elements to get him to a certain
further he's in.
So it reminds me of a discussion I had of, you know, things that take someone to push themselves to do things, and some people say, "I take my rage, I take my anger, and you know, concentrate into a certain direction, and that's how I succeed in something." And so the same thing here. God basically took an element of his personality, concentrated into a certain direction to get him to where he wanted him. So
sure. And so Samson went down to Timnah with his father and his mother and came to the vineyards of Timnah. Now, to his surprise, now here's an interesting little story. To his surprise, a young lion came roaring out against him, a young lion, and the spirit of Yehovah came mightily upon him, and he tore the lion apart as one would have torn apart a young goat. Although he had nothing in his hand, but he did not tell his father or his mother what he had done.
So it's very interesting. What happens here, this is first of all the first time that this super strength comes to him, and it emphasizes the fact that it's divine. It's given to him by God. When he needs it, it's thrown at him. Mm-hmm. And the first time, and as the story develops, it kind of starts sticking to him. He actually stays with him, but here's the first time it happens. Now, what's the first of all interesting that, you know, there's a question, where were his parents? What was going on? And it seems that his parents were probably walking on the main road, and he just wandered off into the vineyard and everything and just walked around. Mm. And there's an interesting thing, because he's walking into this vineyard, and he's a Nazirite, and he's not supposed to, you know, be in a... he's not supposed to eat, let's be very, very blunt. But there's a rabbinic prohibition of a Nazirite even touching leaves. And even touching the leaves of the vine, which kind of like, you know, pokes fun at maybe, not pokes fun, but it kind of shows some level maybe of, you know, disregard he might have. Because, you know, if you walk into a vineyard and there's grapes there, and you know, a lot of people are tempted to pick one and put it in their mouth, which means he wasn't, you know, he might have kept his Nazirite oath, but he was kind of like very edgy about it. He wasn't.
He seems like he's teasing himself. If he's wandering through the vineyard, you know, yeah, it's a bit of a tease. I personally would have avoided it, but in any case, it seems like that's what he's doing.
Yeah, and this lion runs up to him, and he just grabs and he tears it like a young kid. You know, he's probably standing like going, just think of the shock he was in. He's like, how did I do that? But he suddenly had this strength out of nowhere, which reminds me of another prophecy. You know, it says that even the weak would say, I'm a hero. I'm a warrior. You know, it kind of teaches us something. There's even a midrash that says that Samson wasn't really a big guy. There's even a midrash that says that he was about 2 cubits tall. You know, and
he was a midget.
He was smaller than the average schmo. And sure. You know, it doesn't really matter how big you are. It doesn't really matter who you are. If God decides that he wants to use you, he's going to use you. And you'll be kicking and screaming doing it, but you're going to be doing it.
You raise a really good point, and I didn't even think of this, but this is the first time that he uses his superpowers, if you like. This is when the Spirit of Jehovah comes mightily upon him. Of course, we read that phrase earlier on in Judges in regards to Otniel and Gidon, and also, who was the other one, I think?
Yiftach had the same thing as
yes,
well.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, him as well. But you're quite right. It's quite possible that this is the first time in his life that he experiences this. He tears the lion apart, and he's probably standing there in shock going, how did I do that? You're quite right. I never thought of that. And so he doesn't mention it to his father and his mother. Then he went down. Now, it says in verse 7, then he went down and talked with the woman, and she pleased Samson well. After that, you know, sometime after, it says in verse 8, when he returned to get her,
Actually, it says Vishov Miyamim, and Miyamim is usually a word that's used for a year. He might have, what was a bit different. They didn't get engaged, and then several months later they get married, or in some cases a year later. He could have got engaged with her, and a year or two passed. You know, sure. He's not...
Whatever it was, Yoel, it was obviously a considerable time, because bees had settled in the carcass of the lion, and there was like a beehive, if you like. There was honey inside it. And he returned to get her. He turned aside, and as you mentioned, he's not on the main road. It says here specifically, he turned aside to see the carcass of the lion. And behold, a swarm of bees and honey were in the carcass of the lion. He took some of it in his hands and went along eating. And when he came to his father and his mother, he gave some to them, and they also ate. But he did not tell them that he had taken the honey out of the carcass of the lion. Now, is there a problem here?
So there are several things that we have to look at. First of all, eating honey in general, bee's honey, is a big question. And when people ask, you know, are you allowed to eat honey because it comes from bees? Usually people refer to the story of Samson. But I've heard an objection that says, well, he didn't tell his parents. And my answer to that one is he didn't tell his parents it came from the lion.
That's right.
They obviously were able to recognize this was bee honey. Yes. Different. And his parents were obviously righteous people. Obviously, at least his mother was a very righteous woman. So it seems that they were. It's allowed to eat bees honey. Mm-hmm. And the question here, first of all, is hiding the fact that he took it from the lion carcass. There could be two reasons. First of all, he didn't want to tell them what happened. He was keeping it secret, the fact that he's very, very strong. But the other thing is that you have to remember, a lion's carcass is unclean.
Yes.
At the time, people would, you know, bring sacrifices left, right, and center, and he probably didn't tell them that it was, you know, it's unclean honey because it was inside a carcass of a lion. But I think the main point here is he was not telling his parents where the honey came from, and he's still keeping the whole thing of the fact that he's not telling anyone that he's strong, not even his parents. He probably doesn't really understand what's going on. He doesn't really understand why this happened, but he realizes that it's not normal. It's not something that he's supposed to have regularly.
Now I agree with you in regards to the honey, by the way, and also whether or not it's a problem that the honey was taken out of the carcass or the skeleton of the lion, depending on how long it was there, I suppose. The question also is, and I totally agree, because he would have been walking, it's not as if he had a handful of, a scoop's handful of honey. He probably had honeycomb that he was taking. Okay. Another thing to think about, Yoel, is the bees didn't seem to bother him. Is this possibly another sign of his strength, that bee stings, it doesn't seem to be a problem? It's not as if he suited up in a bee suit and went and extracted honey. But in any case, he's walking along with honeycomb. He gives some to his parents. They don't say, "Oh no, we can't have this." They obviously identify honeycomb and they have it. Is it a problem though, Shimshon, as a Nazirite, to touch the carcass of an animal?
So we have to go back to the Book of Numbers and look at the list of things it's prohibited. As far as I know, from what I remember, the answer, it's not a problem. But let's put this very, very quickly. No, the verses really mostly speak about a dead person, which is a different. Because you have to remember, if a dead person, you know, the corpse uncleanliness is 7 days, while touching a carcass of an animal is 1 day. So it's not as severe.
So it's not a problem. It's not a problem. So we can move on.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, by the way, you've been in the Judean desert now for a few weeks. Have you seen any lions?
There are no lions in the Judean desert. There has not been lions for hundreds of years. They were all hunted to extinction. But I've seen deer and stuff like that.
Yeah, really? Any donkeys?
Donkeys from the Arabs mostly.
Okay. And so it goes on. It says that so his father went down to the woman, and Samson gave a feast there for young men used to do so.
Yeah, so I was actually listening to the recording you did with Ira. By the way, very good recording. I really enjoyed it.
And Treasures from the Tanakh with Ira Michelson, yes.
The Book of Job, which is a very difficult book. I dread that book every time I have to read it. But you dealt with there with the word mishteh, and you mentioned the fact that we're going to be talking about Samson, and the thing with the word mishteh, first of all, the word mishteh is from the root of shata, which means to drink. So the difference in between a regular meal and a mishteh is the fact that we're drinking wine. And the other difference is that mishteh is usually used for a celebration. It's not just sitting and eating, because if it's just sitting and eating, there's just, you know, eating bread being the sign of eating. Even in covenants, you know, they sat down to eat bread. It doesn't mean they only ate bread, but bread was the main thing. Here, the main thing is the drinking of wine, which is a sign of celebration. You know, people drink and become kind of tipsy about it, or maybe even completely drunk. And that's one of the differences, which raises the question, did Samson drink wine or not?
Fair enough, because as a Nazirite, he's forbidden to do so.
Exactly, and probably his parents were kind of angry with him for what he was doing. There's also another question that's asked. You know, it says here, as the young men would do, and it reminds me of the discussion you had about the sons of Yov.
Ah, yeah.
And it is a very good question. You know, what exactly were they celebrating? So the answer, first of all, obviously, we're not celebrating any of the feasts. I agree with Ira on that one. Seems as if they had these occasional celebrations. It's just very, very strange what they were doing. And it looks as if there was a, you know, Ish Bet Yomo, they would do a celebration each day at someone else's house, and then he would sanctify them. You know, you have a discussion about sanctification. He basically purified them to do sacrifices. Because what happens during a mishteh is people drink and they become drunk and they do stupid things.
Sure.
And it's basically saying here in the Book of Judges, it's basically saying this is the way they used to celebrate the engagements of people because they're not really married yet. He went to her parents, they made an agreement, he came back later on to actually take her, and now they're having the celebration. And in the celebration, a bunch of very interesting things happen. But the main thing that signifies it, it's a celebration is the word mishteh. So every time you see that, it's not just you know, sitting and having a good time. It's signified by the fact that they were drinking alcohol.
Right, right. And so because it doesn't say explicitly, but if he is included in the consumption of alcohol, then that's certainly breaking his Nazirite vow. And it happened. When they saw him, that they brought 30 companions to be with him. Then Samson said to them, "Let me pose a riddle to you. If you can correctly solve and explain it to me, within 7 days of the feast, I will give you 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes. But if you cannot explain it to me, then you shall give me 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes." And they said to him, "Pose your riddle, that we may hear it." So he said to them. Now, before I read this, Yoel, I mean, I've read it a couple of times, and It happens to flow nicely in the English. I'm interested in how it reads in the Hebrew, because when I read it, I think I don't understand how in the world are they supposed to come up with the answer to this. I mean, it's a bit beyond me, but he says, "Out of the eater came something to eat, and out of the strong came something sweet."
No, the Hebrew's more or less the same.
Truly.
It says, "Me'ha'ochel yata ma'achal u'me'az yata matok." And I mean, you scratch your head and go, "What on earth is he talking about?" It's a very difficult one. It's a very, very difficult.
It is odd. It's odd. I mean, we as the reader, we've read about the lion, and instantly you go, "Oh, he's talking about the lion." But how are they supposed to pick up on that? It's very odd.
But it's odd. But it was actually considered to be normal that people ask riddles and stuff like that in celebrations like this just for the fun. So he wasn't doing something abnormal, but he was asking a very, very difficult riddle because it wasn't something that's known. You know, usually they ask a riddle, and it's something that most people
know. It's esoteric. That's right. It's kind of esoteric. It's not like he handed them a Rubik's Cube and said, "Hey, if you can do that, you know." But he gives them a riddle that the answer is something that he hasn't told anyone about, including his parents.
Yeah, he's kind of being unfair here.
He's being unfair. And now for 3 days they could not explain the riddle. But it came to pass on the seventh day that they said to Samson's wife, entice your husband, that he may explain the riddle to us, or else we will burn you and your father's house with fire. Nice.
Okay, so first of all, there's an interesting thing here I want to point out. They couldn't tell the riddle for 3 days, and then on the seventh day they speak to his wife, and they say to her, "We'll burn you and your father's house on you with fire. Have you called us to be inherited?" Basically, he called us over to celebrate with you, and now we're going to come out here with a loss. What are you doing? It's like, it's as if you were showing up for a wedding, and then they stop you when we're about to leave and say, "Okay, you have to pay money for the wedding." Don't forget about the gift, you're paying for the wedding. And this is what they're complaining about. But there's a problem here with the numbers, because three days they couldn't say, and then the seventh day they tell him. He's given them, on the first day, 7 days to give him the answer.
Mm-hmm.
He tells them, you know, tell me until the, you know, tell them 7 days
of
the...
No, you're right. Yeah, so it says for 3 days they could not explain the riddle, but it came to pass on the seventh day. Now, I've got an asterisk here, Yoel.
Okay.
Okay, so it says following Masoretic text, but in the Vulgate and the Septuagint, it reads fourth.
Yeah, so it's typical of the Septuagint, which the Vulgata is really based on, to correct things when it doesn't really understand what's going on. It's very, very typical. I've seen it many, many times in notes that I have in, say, commentators or, you know, what you have in your Bible. But they mentioned this. It's the correcting because they didn't fully understand what was going on. But essentially, I have to say, even if you correct it to the fourth day, it doesn't solve the problem, because then it says here, they turn to his wife on the seventh day, etc. And then it says here that she cried. The wife of Samson cried upon him, and she said to him, "You hate me, but you hate me, you don't love me." And she says here, the riddle which you riddle to my people, it's sort of like mm-hmm. it's my people against you, mm. and you did not tell me. And he says to her, I didn't tell my father and my mother what I would tell you. And then it says she cried on him for 7 days.
Oh,
so,
true.
So even if you correct that to 4 days, it doesn't solve the problem later on. So it could be, and this is a correction I'm making, it could be that it was, they didn't know for 3 days. On the fourth day, they spoke to her, and then she cried to him the remaining of the 7 days. And that might be the original text. It happens a few times in the Book of Judges. In the next story we have, there's a few places it does it as well. There's kind of a confusion in the text, and we're not too sure why, but because we trust the Masoretic text, we don't change anything. But essentially, yes, the answer is there is a problem with the text here, because we have three, and then seven, and then seven again, but he gave the riddle for 7 days, so how does it fit it? There's a bit of an issue here, so it could be that there's a mistake, but correcting just the four is not enough.
By the way, it shows, I mean, she is clearly unaware of his potential strength, because as they come to her and say, hey, we're going to burn you and your father's house with fire if you don't find out the answer to this riddle, because we ain't paying this we're not copying this up at all. I mean, if she was aware, she could have said, hey, my husband is Samson. He's going to kick your butt, all right? But she's unaware, and so she whinges. She cries. She whines.
But this also gives us another element in his personality. He has a very strong – he's a big weakness to women.
Mm.
He's very weak when it comes to the wife, and it's only at the end where he figures out what has to be done.
Sure.
We're presenting one of his weaknesses where he has a strong weakness to women, and she cries on him, and she whines. She just makes his life a living hell.
She does. And it says because for 7 days, as you said, because she pressed him so much, then she, he tells her, she explains the riddle to the sons of her people. So the men of the city said to him on the seventh day before the sun went down, what is sweeter than honey and what is stronger than a lion? And he said to them, Yoel, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle.
So this entire section is very, very poetic. Mm-hmm. It says to him, it can divide this one, and he said to the people of the city on the seventh day, before the sun set. Now, he uses the word charasa, which is extremely rare, if not the only place where it appears. So this is poetic. Now, the tendency of poetic language, like Ira mentioned us also, and my guess is Nehemiah also said the same thing, we suddenly have what people actually use as a language. So charasa was probably one of the names for the sun at the time, but this entire section is poetic. And they say to him, Ma matok midvash, three words, Uma az me'ari, three and three. And then it says, and he answers it with a poetic thing as well. Lule charashtem be'eglati lo matzetim chidati. There's a rhyme here, and the three words and three words, you know, and it's kind of interesting, this section.
Mm-hmm.
And why is it written like this is very interesting, because, you know, Maybe he did answer this way. You know, they answered in a tune, and he answered the same way, being very sarcastic. But he's basically telling them, "I know how you figured it out, because no one knew except for my wife." But
yes.
The whole thing is, this goes back to what we're saying in what we said in verse 4. For it's an excuse to have a war with the Philistines.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's all. Planned. There's nothing
it's
going
all
on.
Orchestrated. It's all orchestrated.
Exactly.
And, but he keeps his word, right? Because then the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily. He went down to Ashkelon and killed 30 of their men, took their apparel, and gave the changes of clothing to those who had who explained the riddle. And so he's, you know, when I think of that, yeah, well, I think of this blood-stained, dirty laundry. But so his anger was aroused, and he went back up to his father's house.
Yes, he's angry, and he's going home for now.
That's it. He's taking his bat and ball. Actually, he's not even taking his bat and ball, because he leaves his wife there, and his wife then was given to his companions, or his companion, who had been his best man. Is that what you've got in the... That's what I've got in the English. What do you got in the Hebrew?
Yeah, it says the same thing. It says, V'tehi eshet shimshon le'mire'ehu asher re'a lo. It's interesting how they use the word mire'a, because the mire'a can also be from the word ra, or ra'a. Roa, which means that there's a claim I read that they played with here with the words, and instead of saying, you know, companions, they also said evildoers, now people hinting to the future that they can also be a problem for him.
Mm-hmm.
So his wife, and she is his wife, is given away to someone else, one of the people in the party, because, you know, it's kind of embarrassing. He just got up and left. And the father, he just married off his daughter. And you have to remember, this is a society that's has a strong honor code in their world. You know, it's kind of embarrassing. The groom just got up and left after 7 days. So what's the best thing to do? There was someone else there who celebrated with us. Okay, now he's the husband.
Right, because it would make sense that the father would say, okay, so you've rejected my daughter as your wife. You don't want her anymore, so you've divorced her, whatever, so marry her off to the best man. Okay, that's what he does after a while. In the time of wheat harvest, it happened that Samson visited his wife with it. Now, she's still identified as his wife. He visited her with a young goat, and he said, let me go into my wife, into her room, but her father would not permit him to go in. Now, it kind of seems like he's brought a peace offering, and he's got a young goat, and he wants to consummate the wedding, it would appear, you know, sometime later. But it's kind of, in the father's mind, it's like, hey, it's too late, Sunshine. I've given her to someone else because you left in a huff.
And you called him Sunshine, which kind of works with his name.
That's true.
An intentional joke that became serious. Yeah, and he says that you hated her. Sanosaneta. You know, you hated her. This is what he's saying. He's not just saying you don't like her. You've literally despised her.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. Is this potentially another a transgression, another infringement upon Torah when it comes to taking the Deuteronomy 24, taking back a wife that has become someone else's?
But he never divorced her.
That's right.
So this is she is an adulterous woman more, if anything else.
That's right. But so if we had a parallel, it would be David's first wife, Michal, right? It's a similar situation there.
Yeah, and the story there is complex as well, and we'll have to get to it when we get to that story. So she's an adulterous woman, unless the question is, you know, first of all, these are Philistines. They don't really follow Torah. And second of all, Samson, you know, his reaction here is pretty harsh. But he says to him something which is even worse. He says to him, he says to him another thing which is a problem, where he turns around to him and says, you know, she has a sister. She has a younger sister, which takes us back to the discussion regarding is the Torah prohibition of marrying sisters, or is it prohibition of marrying several women at the same time? And I never actually got around. Unfortunately, I don't really have enough time to sit down and listen to Torah Pearls, but I did get around to speaking with someone who did listen to this. And I do want to go back for a second to that section in Leviticus just to tell you what I think about this.
Please.
And the thing is that, just trying to find it. Do you remember exactly? Oh, there it is. It says here in Leviticus 18, verse 18, and a woman to her sister you will not take litzrol. Litzrol is to bundle, to expose her nakedness on her in her life.
Mm-hmm.
And usually the word achot usually means a sister. So my understanding here is it's literally a sister. You know, I'm not supposed to marry sisters. And then people want to jump, what about Jacob? What about Jacob? And the answer is, unlike what people, I've heard from a lot of people, and Jacob, they didn't really follow Torah. There was no Torah at the time. There wasn't Torah. It was not given yet. So there's no issue of marrying. No, I'm telling you very, very bluntly, this idea as if the Torah was given at a very early stage is an esoteric Dead Sea Scroll thing that has no proof in the Bible. There were probably customs. There were probably things that end up inside the Torah as part of what God understood as being righteous behavior. But this understanding that the Torah was given to Enoch or to Noah or to first man or whatever it is, there's no actual proof to it. And the fact remains that Jacob did marry two sisters, and we don't see any criticism about it in the text. On the other hand, there are places we can ask questions. You know, it seems that certain things, certain commandments were known to a certain degree, like, for example, marrying the wife of a deceased brother. But that those are probably things that were customs which God accepted as being the right way to do things, and God put them in the Torah. But when it comes
to... I have a question. While you're here in Leviticus 18:18, in the English, what I have is, nor shall you take a woman as a rival to her sister. What do you have in the Hebrew? Is it similar to that?
No, it doesn't say the word tzara. A rival is tzara. The word litzrol, there are two ways of reading the word litzrol. Let's look at it grammatically. The word tzarah is really tzadi resh hei. Litzror is tzadi resh resh. So the root here is to make them enemies. So if we go, so your translation is actually is accurate, but the automatic understanding of a lot of people is the root of to be an enemy like you have there is the root of tzara, which is tzadi resh hei. Tzara is trouble or something like that. The root here is tzarar, tzadi resh resh, which means to bundle. Okay, there's a difference. You can't really say, I've heard this interpretation that tzror is from the word to be enemies in the house, which is a possibility. I'm not counting that possibility, but the basic root of litzrol, tzarar, you know, if you just open up your dictionary and you look at it, you know, as we speak, I am doing this just to make sure, but if you take the word tzarar, it's to bundle together. And how do you bundle together? You take things and put them together. But on the other hand, we find in many places where people married several wives. You know, King David married several wives. Elkanah, father of Samuel, had two wives. We don't see anyone acting that's prohibited. Now, there are people who say, oh, they did things anyhow, which are forbidden. But again, we don't, you know, you have to assume that's what the text is saying.
True.
And then that it's forbidden. This is why I personally think the word tzalitzol here is to bundle. And I think that what it's actually talking about here is the word achot, because it's very extremely rare. And it's probably poetic language to use the word achot as being two women which are not actually sisters. The word achot is mostly used to mean sister, literally genetically related sister. So I completely reject this idea that there's a prohibition of marrying two wives. I don't see the point in marrying two wives unless one of the wives is barren. That's a good reason to marry. And when I looked into the old customs, say of the Jerusalem Jews, they never married two wives unless the first wife was barren.
Trouble conceiving. Okay, so let me get this right in my head. The way you would read it is, this is, again, for the listeners, Leviticus 18:18, nor shall you take a woman, bundling her to her sister to uncover her nakedness while the other is alive, as opposed to, nor shall you take a woman as a rival to her fellow Israelite woman, or not necessarily sister, to uncover her nakedness while the other is alive. So the former is the way that you would understand it.
Yeah, I'm looking at the dictionary, and he does bring that there are cases where the root of tzadi resh resh can be used as to be enemies, but I'm having difficulty with this because we anyhow find in the Torah, and even in the Torah, we find a theoretical discussion about a man that takes two wives, and you know, and the first wife has her firstborn, but he doesn't love that firstborn. So we can assume that if there's a theoretical discussion about having two wives, and then there's something, the discussion is not about the two wives, but the discussion is about what happens with the first wife that he does not love, and she ever has a firstborn, and he doesn't want the child to inherit, and he's trying to give the inheritance to the firstborn of the second wife. You know, but even if we have such a theoretical discussion, we have to assume that the Torah is allowing marrying two wives, which means it's not an issue of, you know, they're not supposed to take two wives because they're going to be enemies. You have to understand that there's a prohibition here of bundling two sisters together as being part of someone's family, being someone's, you know, someone being their husband and bundling together these wives, because that's probably what it means. I've seen this discussion, the Jewish tradition, and I've never seen anyone. It was a relatively new thing to me when someone tried to say it's in the prohibition of polygamy, because we don't find anywhere in the history of Judaism, and we don't find anywhere in the history of the Bible that there was a prohibition of marrying two wives. But obviously, you know, we have the discussion in the whole thing in Malachi when he talks about what goes on there, and he talks about people marrying another wife, but the case there is probably we're marrying Gentile women, but there was a criticism about the fact that they're abandoning their first wife for no reason. So my assumption is that people married a second wife for a reason. It wasn't just, oh, I'm just going to marry another wife because I fancy another woman. I don't think that was done.
That's a really good point. That's a really good point, and I'm glad you brought that up.
And I think rich people who married more than one wife because they could, and it was rich people who wanted abundant amount of children. You know, a woman, there's a limit to how many children she can have. But a person, you know, thinks about the verse and says, you know, multiply and be fruitful. He wants like 30, 40, 50 children. He can't do that with one wife. You have to have a whole bunch of wives to do that.
Sure. Like some of the guys that we've read about earlier on in Judges who have 30 or 70 sons, for example, as Gideon did. But Yoel, I mean, in this case, her father, in his mind, it's like, hey, you gave this one up. She's not your wife anymore. Too bad. Have her sister. But in Samson's mind, and the way that we might understand this, is that, no, she still is his wife, and the father is now suggesting that he takes the sister also as a wife. And so there begins the conversation, which is hotly debated still today. But he's not happy with that, right?
He's not happy at all, and he just takes revenge, and he says, this time I will be clean from the Philistines. Basically, he's saying, I am going to literally pour my wrath upon them, because Niketi is to clean off. He's just clean off this anger. He's clean off this debt they have towards him, and he's just going to destroy whatever he can. So he's going to rampage, and he's destroying whatever he can destroy.
He's a bit hot under the collar, and he's ready to go. Have you ever caught a fox?
I've seen foxes. Very difficult to chase down.
They really, really are. We've had a few. I see some around here from time to time, and we like to keep an eye out because we've got the chickens and the ducks and so on and so forth. But they're pretty fast. They're pretty fast. But it says that he caught 300 foxes. So here is the second time, I guess, we see his superpowers, perhaps. And he took torches, turned the fox's tail to tail, and put a torch between each pair of tails. And when he had set the torches on fire, he let the foxes go into the standing grains of the Philistines and burned up both the shocks and the standing grain. What's the shocks?
Gadish. So I think the shocks, what I mean here is the piles of grain.
Oh, right. Okay. So the piles of grain and the standing grain, as well as the vineyards and the olive groves.
He basically destroyed their economy.
He did. He brought them down. The Philistines said, who has done this? And they answered, Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnites, because he has taken, now this is the way they say it, because he has taken his wife and given her to his companion. Is the he there would be referring possibly to the father? Because he, the father, has taken his wife and given her to his companion?
Yeah, he's talking about their father.
Makes sense. And so the Philistines came up and burned her and her father with fire, which is exactly what they threatened to do in verse 15 of chapter 14.
So it seems the Philistines were very big on burning people.
Yeah, they're not nice. And so Samson said to them, since you would do a thing like this, I will surely take vengeance on you. And after that, I will cease. So he attacks them. Hip and thigh is what I've got in the English. Yoel, what's that about?
He says, Vayachotam shok al yarech, makah gedola. It's a very interesting way to describe it. He hits them. He attacks them. Shok al yarech. So there's two ways of explaining this. That some people say that every person he hit, he would hit, basically smacked them down where they basically fell on their hip and thigh. Basically were rolling all over the place. He just, every person he would hit once, and that person would just collapse. And
right.
It says a great smiting. He basically went in and just went rampage around there, and he probably was barehanded. And every person he hit, that person collapsed, which is basically describing how strong he was.
Sure.
Believe me, you know, when you do martial arts, there is a way of intensifying the way you hit a person. But even in a fight, even if it's barehanded, it takes a while until you actually can kill a person. You have to get the person into a certain position, and then you grab them in a certain way. And then, you know, for example, you know, in movies where they show neck breaking, it's not that simple.
Sure.
I've spoken with people who in their military service had to protect themselves, and one guy had to break a neck. And he said, it's not that simple.
No, I don't doubt it.
It's not simple at all. But here the description is, you know, he just walks up, guy walks up to him, hits him one time with his hand, and this guy's just completely shocked, probably broke something on the way, and the guy's dead. This is how intense his power was.
That's how it seems. That's the way it comes across. And now the Philistines went up and camped. Now, he goes and dwells in a cleft of the rock of Etam. Where's Etam?
I don't really know. You want to look at a map, maybe? I'll tell you.
It says here, I've got in the notes, it says Etam is otherwise known. Oh, is otherwise unknown, it says. Yeah, okay, so we don't know where Etam is. Possibly, maybe the rocky crags near Zora.
They say maybe it's Chirbet Chavach Aliyad Ein Etam. So it might be Chirbet Chavach, which is near the place called Ein Aten, which is a very similar name, south of Bethlehem, near the Pools of Solomon. You say that Seif HaSela, the cliff or the rock, is probably east of Etam, the coming near to the Judean Desert. So this book assumes that they know where it is. You can never know 100% with these names. You can find places with similar names, and it could be it might not be it. It might be that they moved it's a couple miles down the road. It's just the name was there, moved to here because this became the main one. So they just copied the name and brought it over this area. Mm. It's not clear. For example, there's a place called Kofel Tafuah, village of Tapuach, and Tapuach is mentioned in the Book of Joshua. Is it literally on the place called? Place called Kfar Tapuach, the original. The answer is we don't know. It's like the same thing. I was doing the recording with Keith about the time of the creator's time, and we went to a place called Bet El, and in Bet El there's a place called Bithin, and another thing that sounds like Bet El. Another, there's like five places around us which were mentioned, which have a similar name to Bet El. Which one of them sits near the biblical Bet El? We don't know, and we actually can't dig in the area, so there's no way of knowing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it goes on, now the Philistines went up, anyhow, and encamped in Judah and deployed themselves against Lehi. Do we know where Lehi is?
Lehi. Lehi usually means a cheek. And the Lehi here, this is probably a case where the name of the place is mentioned before it's even named that way. Because he does something here. It's like, for example... In the book of Exodus, it says that Moses went with his flocks to the mountain of God, which is Horeb. Why is it mentioned called the mountain of God? It wasn't called mountain of God at the time. It's called mountain of God later on, but it's written after that name was given. The same thing here. The name of the place is mentioned so people can identify it, but it's the name was given after what happened.
So it refers to a cheek, which makes perfect sense, and we're about to read why. It says, the men of Judah, they came and they said, why have you come up against us? And so they answered, we have come up to arrest Samson to do to him as he has done to us. And there's the principle that you were referring to earlier on. Then 3,000 men of Judah went down to the cliff of the rock of Etam and said to Samson, do you not know that the Philistines rule over us? What is this that you have done to us? And he said to them, as they did to me, so I have done to them. But they said to him, well, we've come down to arrest you, that we may deliver you into the hand of the Philistines. And Samson said to them, all right, well, swear to me that you will not kill me yourselves. And so they swore to him, saying, I won't kill you, but we will tie you securely and deliver you into their hand, but we will surely not kill you. And they bound him up with two new ropes and brought him up from the rock. And when they came to Lehi, the Philistines came shouting against him. Then the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and the ropes were as if on his arm were like flax that had been burned with fire, and these bonds broke loose from his hands, and he found what in verse 15?
He finds the cheekbone, a fresh cheekbone of a donkey.
Okay, so I'm assuming, I've never seen one. Have you seen one?
Well, a donkey?
No, a donkey's like the skeletal remains of a donkey.
Yeah.
Okay, so describe it to us. I mean, is it a decent size? I imagine it would be.
It's big enough to be a small club.
Okay,
I've seen those we had up north when I was growing up in the Galilee, or even in Samaria when I was living in there. I found, the thing with the Arabs, they bury the donkeys that die. There's a thing called Kvurat Chamor. The burial of a donkey where there's just dumped the body and, there's a whole thing when someone's disrespectfully buried, they call it a kvurat chamor, the burial of a donkey, where they just dig a hole, dump the body in and cover it up and put a mound over it. So there have been cases where, dogs dug up the bones and everything, and you pull out, if you remember something, donkeys, why are they able to, why did I mention the fact that they're the Volvo of...
last week, yeah, you did.
Last week I mentioned that. Is because they have very condensed muscles. They have, condensed, not only muscles, but bones. They're extremely condensed. So they're small, but they're very, very strong. So the cheekbone, when it's fresh, and when things dry up, they start crumbling, but when it's fresh, it's really, really hard. So you pick up this thing, you put it in your hand, and it has like a curve where the cheek attaches to the upper one. So my assumption is that he picked up the lower cheek, okay? And sure. It's a line, and then it curves and becomes almost like a club at the end. And he picked this thing up, and he just starts bashing heads in.
And he starts bashing heads in, and he takes out 1,000 of them.
Mm-hmm.
My goodness. Now he says, now here's some, I'm assuming this is more poetry, Yoel. After bashing heads in with a cheekbone of a tonkie, 1,000 of them, I've got in the English, with the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey, I have slain 1,000 men.
So there's a discussion about the chamor chamorotaim, chamorotaim. There's it says in Hebrew, Vayomer Shimshon, and Samson said, Belechi hachamor, the cheekbone of the cheek of the donkey, chamor chamorotaim. So chamor chamorotaim is probably a game with the word chamor, which means donkey, and chamar, which means piles. It mentions about the frogs in Egypt. It's berotam chamarim chamarim. So chamarim means heaps. So it's a game. He's playing a game with the word chamor and heaps, donkey and heaps, chamor chamorotaim. And then he says, "Belechi achamor heketi elefish with the jaw of the donkey. I have hit down or smown down 1,000 men." So it is kind of a poetry. He's light poetry, you can call it.
You know, it's interesting as well, Yoel. It seems that they came to get him with 1,000 men.
Yeah, and he showed them what it is. One guy hits 1,000 men, and I think it says that one of you will chase down 1,000, and 10 of you will chase down 10,000. Is that the verse I'm looking for?
Yeah, remember? True. Now that's Leviticus 26:7-8. You will chase your enemies, and they shall fall by the sword before you. 5 of you shall chase 100, and 100 of you shall put 10,000 to flight. Your enemies shall fall by the sword before you. In this case, a donkey jaw.
So we have to remember this is Samson, so he gets bigger numbers.
He gets bigger numbers. He gets higher score on the board.
It's usually 20 per person, but this is Samson. He's several times stronger, so he gets 1,000.
He gets 1,000, so he gets huge points on the board. And so it was when he had finished speaking that he threw the jawbone from his hand and called that place Ramat Lehi.
The hill of Lehi, or the high place of Lehi.
Okay, heaps of cheeks.
Yeah, but the thing is, what happens here is very interesting. He says, I have smitten down 1,000 men with the jaw of a jaw of a donkey, and then he gets a wake up call when he becomes thirsty.
True, that's a really good point. I didn't see that, but he kind of claims the glory for himself, and all of a sudden he becomes incredibly thirsty. That's a really good point. In verse 18, then he became very thirsty, so he cried out to Yehovah and said, "You have given this great victory by the hand of your servant. Now can I have something to drink?"
He says, "Now I will die by thirst, and I will fall in the hands of these uncircumcised." Again, the uncircumcised thing, and
that's a really good point. I didn't see that because he claimed the victory, the glory for himself. Then he's dying of thirst. He said, "No, you have done it. Oh God, you have done it. It was you, boy. You're good. Can I have a drink, please?"
So this is a very, very important thing that we have to understand. Every time we have success. You know, when you hear Jews talking about success and everything, they always say Baruch Hashem. You know, may the name be blessed, because it becomes very clear that, you know, any success, anything we do in life, you know, it doesn't matter what we do, but we always have to realize, yes, we did what we did, but if it wasn't for God helping push the idea into reality, it wouldn't have happened. You know, there are a lot of people who come up with ideas, and they all do the same thing. Some succeed, some don't, but they're all doing more or less the same thing. What's going on? And the answer is, it's because God wants it to happen.
Amen.
And it's the same thing here. You know, Samson succeeded. And he says, "Oh, look at me! I'm so strong." And if we go back to the blessings and curses in Leviticus, and he says, "Kochi ve'amata ve'amo kochi ve'otzem yadi asali et ha'chayil hazeh." And you say on that day that your strength and the might of your hand did all this success for you. And this is what happens. So with him, because he's divinely connected straight with a divine download, as Keith Sontan says. Yes, the answer is that with him it's more direct. You do something, okay, here's the answer. And he recognizes it, but he keeps on forgetting. So he's also symbolically kind of like the people of Israel. he goes after his eyes. We have to think again of Numbers, where he talks about the tzitzit. They want to follow after your own eyes, but he does it anyhow. And then he recognizes the fact that he's mistaken, so he's able to smite down his enemies. But then he makes a mistake again, and he gets punished, and then he turns it back to God. So the motif of the book of Judges also is embedded in the character of Samson. This is why probably he's the last judge, because there's a lot of symbols inside his character and inside his stories, which also kind of represent the whole idea of the book of Judges as well.
That's true. And so so it seems that God split the hollow place that is in Lachi, and water came out, and he drank, and his spirit returned, and he revived. Therefore, he called its name. What is this?
Ein HaKoreh Asher Balechi. Ein HaKoreh is the fountain of the calling, or the HaKoreh is the one who called, so the fountain of the one who called, which is in Lechi. So again, they give names based on things that happened. So Ein is usually the fountain itself where the water comes out. Basically, with something called the eye of the fountain, where the water actually comes out. And HaKoreh, Koreh is a caller. HaKoreh is the caller. And Koreh is also a verb. Here it's a verb that's used mostly as an adjective here. But it's the eye of the caller. And it's because he called out in prayer, which is typical for the Bible, giving names based on things that happened.
That happened, for sure. Now, speaking of things that happened, it's interesting that this is the last verse of chapter 15, Yoel, and it says, "And he judged Israel 20 years in the days of the Philistines." Now, you would be forgiven for thinking, well, there it is. That's the story of Shimshon. That's the story of Samson, right?
No, it's not the end.
It's not the end. There's a whole other chapter that we're going to have to get to next week, which is probably... Well, certainly is the highlight of Shimshon's career. And it's interesting to note that it ends, chapter 16, it ends the same way. He judged Israel 20 years. So this is obviously, chapter 16 is something that occurs in that space of time. So we won't give too much away, but obviously Samson and Delilah is coming up next week.
And then now we should sing the song by, what's his name?
Go on.
Remember his name now. It's called Delilah. And it's, I can't remember his name now. There's a guy who sang this song called Delilah. It's why?
Oh, Tom Jones.
Exactly, Tom Jones.
Oh, my goodness. He gets himself into some trouble.
Yeah. So, by the way, it's an interesting thing. You know, you think of Samson. You know, when I was growing up, my mother always told me, I have to eat the crust of the bread. It'll give me strength like Samson. And I looked at my mother and said, "Who are you kidding?" But I ended up being the biggest son in the family. So, you know, eat your crust. And when you think of Samson, he probably wasn't that big. I mean, people at the time were relatively small. But I keep on remembering these movies. There were several movies made about Samson. And they always found these bodybuilders to be...
some sort of Arnold Schwarzenegger-looking character. And
it's kind of interesting. You know, we should sometimes kind of like push out television from completely out of our lives, and movies completely out of our lives, because they create a very strong misconception regarding things. And you know, there were at least three movies made about Samson, and they all had these big bodybuilders playing the character. Who says he was that big? You know, he might have been a tiny little guy. He might have been, 5'3", very, very skinny and everything, you know, nerdy looking. And he just had long hair, and then lo and behold, what this guy was able to do. So
we're gonna read about that, because it actually says, in 16, we'll get into it next week, but it says, "The Philistines came to Delilah and said, entice him and find out where his great strength lies." In other words, this guy didn't have muscles on his muscles. Otherwise, they'd know where his great strength lies.
Exactly.
Okay, chapter 16, next week, boys and girls. Thank you, Yoel Ben Shlomo. His Facebook page, Hebrew in Israel. If you haven't been there, go there, like the page and engage. And if you would like Hebrew lessons from the Levite in the desert, you can inquire by emailing at hebrewinisrael@gmail.com, hebrewinisrael@gmail.com. And if these programs have been a blessing to you, dear listener, you can show your support by donating at truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org. And next week, we're going to be finishing the story of Samson in the book of Judges, chapter 16. You've been listening to Light of the Prophets. Until then, dear listener, be blessed, set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom.